The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome to the program today David Paul Kuhn. He joins us on the telephone. Where are you, David?
I'm actually calling you from Connecticut.
Connecticut. You have just published a book called The Hard Hat Riot, Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the White Working Class Revolution. What made you decide to write a book about this subject?
Well, after Trump won in 2016, I felt like it was, so whether you're on the left or the right, it was a seismic change in American life and certainly to American politics. And for all that was being written and said about it, I felt that there was a dearth, a great deal of not only misunderstanding, but a lack of understanding of sort of the history that made this moment possible, a history that both exceeded Trump and paved the way for what he, for his presidency. And I had long written about Democrats' problems with blue-collar whites, winning them and why they lost them, and why Republicans had been winning them in recent generations. And I decided that I wanted to pick the most potent and most and best lesson of history to do some storytelling and bring readers back to a moment that made our present, and you know, then put it in context and explain the backdrop and what was the aftermath. So I chose the Hard Hat Riot because it really is, in the last 50 years, especially when you go back to the beginning of modern polarization, the best microcosm for the divorce, if you will, between the old FDR coalition and the old left and the new left, between what we call today working-class whites and the Democratic Party.
Could we call it the fracturing of liberalism?
Absolutely, because, you know, for especially for older Americans, they remember, you know, a different version of liberalism, for one. Well, first of all, let's just set aside political philosophy and what that word means in political philosophy. But, you know, liberalism, in this era that, you know, I returned readers to in the late 60s, you have the rise of the new left, and liberalism changes with it. But at this time, you know, many blue-collar workmen and women still considered, some considered themselves liberals, and when they use that word, they were referring to the FDR era and a different conception of liberalism. And so you could call it the fracturing of liberalism, absolutely.
We recently marked the 50th anniversary of the campus shootings that took place in May of 1970, and as I read your book, I kept thinking, we've heard so much about that, particularly the one at Kent State, even though there was another one at Jackson State in Mississippi that is less known. We don't know that much about the Hard Hat Riot. I had sort of a vague memory of it. I had no clue what really happened. This is amazing. Why is this kind of a forgotten part of history?
Well, there's many reasons, but as I say pretty explicitly in my introduction, and I do believe this, you know, as we all learn when we're freshman history students in college or in high school, winners write history. And we think of that idea in terms of war between nations. Mm. But it's also about cultural conflicts within nations. And I think one reason, it's hard to prove, but I think it's profoundly true, is that the people who are writing the history are the children, are sons or of the baby boomer generation, or daughters, or they're literally of the baby boomer generation that was on one side of this cultural divide, and that is, you know, what was then called the New Left. And I think that this highly educated, liberal, or more urbane group, which is just a generalization but statistically true in general, is also the authors of much of our history and the purveyors of much of our media out of Hollywood and New York, where I usually call home. And I think that's one reason. Stories of sort of the other side of the 60s are often less told. Number two, you know, sometimes moments of history need their present. So, for example, take a famous riot only less than a year before the Hard Hat Riot, and that is what happened in the Village in New York City, Stonewall. Mm-hmm. Stonewall, the seminal moment that we think of today in the gay rights movement, was barely covered. It was on, like, I don't remember exactly, but, like, let's just say, like, page 30 of the New York Times, a few column inches. There were like, two stories about it. It was barely noticed at the time. And later, decades later, in fact, it became this seminal moment, you know, sort of this hinge moment that we now recognize in the gay rights movement. And the Hard Hat Riot, perhaps because the media, much as they did in 1969 when Nixon won his victory, kind of woke up in 2015 and 16 as Donald Trump becomes a feasible candidate. The coastal media wakes up to the fact that there's this entire demographic of America, and look, there are more than 4 in 10 voters who is gravitating to this outside candidate, and the media sort of rushes to catch up and understand them. But this, you know, they certainly long understood themselves. And I think, you know, if I can go off track for a second, I think one reason for this, for the story not being told until then, is that really most people were not paying it. Most people, I mean, most people in the media and academia were not paying attention to this part of America, what is sometimes referred to as middle America or flyover country. Mm. And I put that in quotes, until they suddenly realized that it's them that could cause such shockwaves and really vote in a different direction than they would hope.
David Paul Kuhn joins me. His book is The Hard Hat Riot, Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the White Working Class Revolution. I was really intrigued by the way you describe the way this all happened. And I'm a person who is intrigued by Richard Nixon. And you show us in the pages of this history how Richard Nixon really was a brilliant politician, and he had some very able people with him. And I don't think it's any accident that we hear our current president using terms like silent majority. Now, was that term coined by Pat Buchanan?
It's, you know, I don't definitively say that in my book.
Okay.
Because it's complicated. But what I do say, which is historically right, is it's almost surely Pat Buchanan who gave that term to Richard Nixon.
Okay.
You know, it's very hard to understand the history of a lexicon that a president says and where it derives, but it's clear that effectively, the short of it is that after Chicago 68, right, the upheaval at the Democratic Convention, Pat Buchanan sees the gap, he sees the opening before the media does, and perhaps before many Republican strategists near him, and he sees that that there's a great portion of America that's going to identify not with the anti-war protesters or the activists who are battling the cops, but with the blue-collar cops themselves. And so he writes a memo around this period, right, speaking of the silent majority. And by 1969, at a peculiar and interesting moment for Nixon, he gives his famous silent majority speech, which was probably the most successful of his presidency. So I think you can credit Buchanan as much as you can credit anyone.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what was the Hard Hat Riot?
On April 20th of 1970, Nixon pledges to withdraw 150,000 troops from Vietnam. It seems like the war is winding down. At this time, the war is not popular with most of America, with the majority of Americans. Then 10 days later, 10 days after his pledge withdrawal, Nixon announces the expansion of the war into Cambodia. It causes, it radicalizes the anti-war movement like never before. The anti-war movement had been flagging. It reinvigorates. And then, of course, as many of your listeners will know, soon after, over the weekend, there's in a college few people had heard of outside of Ohio called Kent State. Students ransacked the town a bit, and by Monday, tensions are high, and there's a tragic confrontation between National Guardsmen and protesters, leading in 13 seconds to 4 dead students, wounding 9 and killing 4. It's upheaval like nothing we've seen since then. And then in New York City, which has some 40 colleges, protesters are on Wall Street every day protesting basically because they view them as the masters of war, the unrivaled center of Western capitalism. But coincidentally, above them are a lot of construction workers, and that's because New York City is experiencing its second skyscraper age, to quote the Times architecture critic at the time. And buildings are being built across, the modern financial district is being built, including most famously the World Trade Center, where there are upwards of 5,000 construction workers alone. So by an accident of history, you had two slices of America that had two tribes that viewed each other almost inconceivably different and had diametrically opposing views of patriotism and of sacrifice and of work and motherhood, I mean, of culture itself and values. Mm-hmm. And they just, by coincidence, were condensed into this narrow space of still colonial lower Manhattan, only a kilometer wide down there at that time. And what happens is this gradual escalation of tension downtown between these workmen and we'll just call them the hard hats and the hippies. And by Friday, the Friday after Kent State, is the hard hat riot, where quite literally at high noon, construction workers break up an anti-war protest, and a brutal riot takes place where you know, construction workers beat scores of hippies, and hardheads beat scores of hippies, to use a shorthand, and they seize City Hall. Police let a lot of it happen because they sympathize with the construction workers, and it is a brutal episode, utter chaos in Lower Manhattan, and it's shocking news because these are men who are supposed to be of the old left, the base of the Democratic Party still at the time, and you have this moment where the old left is attacking the new left. And then by Monday, you have a stunning turnout. 7,000 come down on Monday to downtown Manhattan, construction workers, longshoremen. And then suddenly every day, blue-collar workers are protesting in Manhattan. And from Richard Nixon's vantage point, for the first time after years of protests against him, suddenly, it seems to him, there are protesters in the streets for him, and it becomes the most important moment in his, what became his blue-collar strategy and his reach for the silent majority.
Mm. The book is The Hard Hat Riot, Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the White Working Class Revolution, written by David Paul Kuhn, who joins us on the telephone in Connecticut today. And I'll continue my conversation with David right after this. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, your home for independent news and handpicked music. It's the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis, joined on the telephone today by David Paul Kuhn. We're talking about his book, The Hard Hat Riot, Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the White Working Class Revolution. You take us blow by blow through the Hard Hat Riot. What kind of material did you have to go through to get all this information? I mean, we're literally going from one hippie getting wailed on to the next hippie getting wailed on and the police ignoring it mostly and just wild and crazy stuff. Where'd you get all this information?
It took me a year of what are called FOIA in New York State, FOIA requests, but effectively Freedom of Information Act requests that didn't bear a lot to New York City agencies, to the FBI. That didn't bear a lot of fruit. I got somewhere. Then I found out that there was this lawsuit that pulled all these. Basically, what I was going for is the NYPD, unlike Kent State, unlike Chicago 68, and unlike the Columbia occupation, seminal moments in the upheaval of the era, there was no third-party investigation of the Hard Hat Riot. But I did know that the NYPD, because of political pressure from Mayor John Lindsay, had been forced to investigate what went wrong. And they largely acquitted themselves a few months later, not surprisingly. Uh-huh. But it was the files beneath that investigation that I wanted, because the NYPD then, like now, was highly professional in their intelligence and their research. And so I wanted to get those documents. I thought they might still exist. So first I did end up getting all the legal affidavits, which for lawsuits related to it. And then eventually, through this other litigation that moved the intelligence records outside the purview of the NYPD, after getting some documents through them through Freedom of Information Act requests, I eventually found this treasure trove of documents from their own investigation. And it was, boxes upon boxes, more than 20 boxes, as they were in 1970. They had not been read in any significant way since the police closed the case in 1970. And because of some very kind New York City archivists, who, while they hadn't gone through it professionally yet or redacted information, uh-huh, because they sort of believed in the spirit of the law, that, they believed that I had a right to see these documents. I saw them early on, and it became the meat, the center protein of this entire narrative, because the book is three parts, and as you know, the center of the book, this part two, is the ride itself. And I wanted to tell us, I wanted to bring readers into the moment, and in that part, truly give them the play-by-play and help them understand, well, firstly, how brutal the moment was. And in that moment, I want to also show a police role, which had never been reported at the time, that the police effectively let this happen, and to what degree they let it happen, and how much they buried the worst moments of the riot. But I also wanted to use this most brutal of moments, to, which then leads to largely peaceful protests for the weeks after. I wanted to use this moment to understand, sort of to convey the fire of the era. It's as much as is going on in American life, it's not the late 60s. It's not the 60s and early 70s. And that's one of the many things that the reader will be remember as they dive into this book.
Well, you really hit the jackpot when they let you look in those boxes. And in another way, you hit the jackpot for timing, because we're in a period right now where there's all this protest going on and there's all this question about police departments. And here 50 years ago, we had this police department that was cheering on the hard hats as they were beating up the hippies.
You can see it from both sides. You see warnings for the police and you see warnings for the left. The obvious warning for the police is you have to be impartial protectors of the peace, even if you have personal feelings against those you're forced to protect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's obvious. But the other lesson that I think is less noticed is the lesson for the left. The radical left at that time, the young people at the time are on the steps of Federal Hall. So the Hard Hat Riot, we should remind readers and listeners, takes place at the very place that George Washington was inaugurated. So it's this very powerful, right near Wall Street and the New York Stock Exchange, very, very resonant part of American history. And the day before, there are people on the mic saying, kill the pigs. The left had only in recent years taken on this language that towards police, and perhaps it shows the dangers also of making the police, broad brushing the police and making them an oppositional force. So I think there's lessons for the police there, and I think it's fair to have a higher expectation of police than anyone, because they are backed by tax dollars and an agent of the state. At the same time, I think there's lessons for the activist left as well.
Another really big part of the story, and you cover this in great depth, is the role of the mayor of New York City, John Lindsay. Tell us about him. A lot of people don't remember him.
Yeah, he was cinematic. It's easy to forget. He was compared to Kennedy. He was said to have Kennedy magic. He was extremely handsome, tall, to the manner born of the WASP aristocracy, though I should note that it's his father who earned his way onto what was called the Social Register at the time. He became a liberal icon. He was a liberal Republican, but that word Republican can confuse things. You can just think of him as a liberal. He became ever more liberal as the 60s became ever more liberal. And he, around the time of the riot and Kent State, around 1970, early 70s, he's suddenly the most popular politician college students and sort of the center of the new left. And in New York City, he beta tests what would be called the McGovern Coalition and later really became the Democratic Coalition. What at the time was a high-low coalition, meaning rich or affluent or upper-middle-class whites. And at the time, because not a large black middle class or wealth sector like today, there were poor blacks or working class blacks and poor and working class Puerto Ricans. And he tests this coalition before anyone could, and it could only be tested in New York then, because only New York City was diverse enough to even make that coalition possible. And so you have this, just like so much of New York City, that it's almost unfathomable today to think of New York in these terms. You have this metaphor for what's happening in America, because what is also worth reminding listeners and readers is that New York City at this time is a blue-collar city. That, for example, the majority of the residents in New York City are blue-collar whites. It experienced a deindustrialization of America, the for America, and would suffer that pain as a precursor of the rest of America, because in the World War II era and even into the 50s, it was an epicenter of manufacturing. Again, hard to imagine that now. You know, tens of thousands, eventually hundreds of thousands of these jobs are disappearing in New York at the time, these blue-collar good jobs. And New York becomes, and on top of all that, you have urban decay. So New York, like most major cities at that time, was descending. And basically by the late 60s, we associate with the mid-70s, but it was happening by the late 60s. In the 60s, New York City, the emphysema rate went up 500%. Mm. Pollution's everywhere. The crime, the murder rate goes up in New York in the 60s, triples in New York, even though the population remains the same and convictions lessen. In America writ large, the violent crime rate goes up 125% in the 60s. So one difference between now and then is how serious crime was and how serious pollution was, especially crime. But, you know, basically the whole of New York City is decaying, and these people who, these blue-collar whites, basically see a mayor who is the first use of the word limousine liberal. Mm-hmm. And they see a mayor who only cares about people below them economically and people above them economically. And you start to see this early break between a famed liberal, a celebrity, and what were then blue-collar whites.
And a lot of the vitriol that was directed by the hard hats toward the protesters, towards the anti-war activists, was also being directed towards Mayor Lindsay. And a lot of the action takes place because at City Hall, they had the flag, the American flag, at half-staff because of the Kent State shootings. And the hard hats didn't like that.
That's right. First of all, we should note that the construction workers, the majority of the construction workers were veterans of either Korea, World War II, and some of the younger ones, Vietnam itself. It's only in the 60s, in the Vietnam era, that the desecrating the American flag or turning it upside down becomes a widely used means to express disfavor with America. And the two veterans, if not, you know, quote, middle Americans, unquote, writ large, this was a shocking phenomenon. And then at the same time, you have that, this sense that of dilution of the meaning of those colors. You have this feeling that they're lowering frankly, to many veterans, this feeling that they're lowering the flag for four dead students at Kent State. And those students, I think it's fair to say many veterans did not believe they deserved to die, and there was an awful moment. But, you know, they were wondering why the mayor isn't on other days lowering the flag for them and for the veterans dying in Vietnam and in their minds dying because, you know, because their country called. So you have this amazing, startling, and traumatic moment that captures dueling concepts of patriotism and how we view our country. And that's at the very heart, if anything's at the heart of the Hard Hat Riot in this moment, that's right there.
The book is The Hard Hat Riot, Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the White Working Class Revolution. David Paul Kuhn wrote it. He joins us on the phone today. In the book nook, he's out in Connecticut, and you do a superb job of showing us the animosity between these groups. You quote a lot of the hippies. I like calling them hippies. They weren't all hippies, obviously. In fact, some of them were perfectly innocent, but if you had long hair and you were given the peace sign, boom, you could get whacked over the head by one of these construction workers or by a police officer. And there's a lot of verbal abuse going on. They're saying really bad things to the hard hats. And you have signs. You reproduce some signs in your text, which I was impressed with, where the word Nixon, the X is turned into a swastika. You've got hippies waving the Viet Cong flag. This is very inflammatory. It's amazing to think about the capacity for violence there and the violence that took place. And yet, no one died, and only one hard hat got arrested. This is amazing.
Yeah, the fact that only until my book, that was not reported, and it's still so grossly misunderstood, the capacity of the violence when you read what's on the Internet. For all the violence, only one hard hat is arrested, which is startling. And, you know, again, at least roughly, I'm just going to say roughly, let's just say 8 to 12, give or take, young men are beaten unconscious in the streets. And you're absolutely right. It's not just, I would say the worst brutality happened because, let's just put it this way. It's at this moment of chaos, both quote-unquote hippies and those who seem to look like one fell prey in innocence, and provocateurs were attacked, and it was a terrible moment of brutality. And there's no whitewashing how brutal the beatings by many of these constructions were, but it's just like with everything about the trauma of the era, it's also important to step back and like we do with the riots in Detroit or Newark or Stonewall, as we were talking about, to look at those root causes. And the provocation was brutal in the words as said. And you know, I think in their, it just escalated and escalated. And I think in the construction workers' minds, it's fair to say at the time, they just had reached, as one did say, he reached his boiling point. And you really just have this moment where they lose their cool. And it gets much more brutal, much more quickly than I think anyone or most people in the moment expected. And the violence gets out of hand in part because the police let it get out of hands. And you have this almost Hobbesian brutal state of nature downtown Manhattan, again, the epicenter of global capitalism. And people, tens of thousands are watching. And, you know, it's this moment where the construction workers, you know, first of all, in one comment to the cops, they are thinking of themselves then as a silent majority, and they just, in their minds, they don't want to be quiet anymore. They sort of, and it's no coincidence that it happened as the anti-war movement radicalized as never before. I should note here that it's important to understand that there's a lot of misconceptions about blue-collar America at this time, working-class America, even middle-class America, and therefore these construction workers who are a metaphor for that. They're not pro-war. If you look at the data, they've been described as pro-war, and the media often misunderstood them as that, and so did Nixon, I should add. They weren't pro-war. They just were pro-America. In other words, the country's turned against the war by this time, but they hadn't turned against their concepts of America. They believed the war had gone bad, but they didn't believe the country was bad. And the new left misunderstood the fact that those two things are very different. The media misunderstood it. But these veterans, the majority of them didn't want it out of Vietnam, the construction workers, and they said so in their blue-collar protests that culminate in 150,000 protests in Lower Manhattan peaceably and in the weeks after. And most of them had not voted for Nixon in 1968, but they did feel that the presidency, the office, demanded a degree of respect. And again, this is the America before the Watergate tapes.
Mm-hmm.
It's America that believes more in government. It's America that has much more reverence for the Oval Office. It's America that has much more reverence for the flag itself. It's America where a far higher proportion of men served in the military, and they certainly had family who had served in World War II. And so it's very important to understand. And this was all the context of not so long ago and sort of the America that makes our modern polarization.
Those are some excellent points, David. And I'd also like to make the point that not all the police ignored the situation. Some of them intervened. You do have police who are ignoring what's going on or who couldn't be bothered to arrest people or who protected hard hats who had committed violence or who let hard hats ride on the back of their moving patrol cars waving the American flag. But you also had police who stepped in and saved people and did their jobs.
Completely. And yeah. I show that in the book, and it's very important to remember that. And it's not as if, and there were officers who did dive in to save, quote, hippies. And there were officers who tried to push the hard hats back, and it was all degrees. It's important. The police have, we have to separate out this current moment and just say that the police are held to a higher standard. And the impartiality of that day is important to report, but they shouldn't be broad-brushed any more than the anti-war movement and hippies or blue-collar whites. And there were definitely cops who tried to keep the peace and tried to stop the first charge. But it's fair to say too many cops did too little.
My guest is David Paul Kuhn. His book is The Hard Hat Riot, Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the White Working Class Revolution. The Book Nook will continue right after this. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is David Paul Kuhn. His book, The Hard Hat Riot, Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the White Working Class Revolution. And you wanted to take us back to Chicago for a moment.
Yeah, what's interesting about one of the interesting lessons of Chicago 68 and the Democratic Convention was that the cops who had attacked or hit and were highly provoked, as I point out, but clearly had attacked and beat up anti-war protesters in Chicago, the media they saw their children. In their minds, they saw that their kids were getting beat up. In their minds, the activists thought they won with martyrdom, but what they found out was that the public sided with the police, that they saw their sons and daughters in the police officers and the blue-collar cops. And you see this running thread, whether it's Chicago, Kent State, or the Hard Hat Riot. In other words, with the National Guardsmen, as awful as it is, the majority of the public believe that the students brought it on themselves, whether that's fair or not. I don't think it is fair, but that just shows the degree of vitriol that they had for the anti-war movement and the radical left at that time, and how much that left had lost the American public. And with the Hard Hat Riot, it's the same thing. You see them siding with the hard hats over the, quote, hippies. And what you see as the running thread here is that the majority of the public Americans see themselves more in the blue-collar cops than the college-educated new left. And so you start seeing this, which is one of the things I'm trying to convey in the book and capture, because I think it's under-discussed in American life, is see this immense class divide tearing apart the Democratic Party. And, for example, the Columbia occupation, when students occupied several halls of Columbia in a precursor to Chicago in 1968, there was another confrontation between the NYPD and the students, and in one poll found then that a majority of white Catholic Brooklynites had family or a close friend in the NYPD. And so what happens with the Hard Hat Riot, you start to see, whether it's the construction workers or the police officer on the other side of the divide, the anti-war movement or the activist left, you see this, you really see the class fissure tearing apart the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the role of class in American life is tremendously under-discussed, and especially its role in severing the FDR coalition of old.
Well, you really have some provocative things in here. It's so interesting to read this book, and I was very impressed with the way that you closed out the story here. You... Near the end of the book, you state that once Watergate brought Nixon down, it would not be conservatives who paid. Ronald Reagan realized Nixon's dream of a new majority with the Democrats who bore his name. Reagan's 1980 campaign plan reflected Nixon's blue-collar strategy. But Reagan's other impulse, his Goldwater outlook, benefited from Nixon's final loss. Liberals relished Nixon's downfall, but liberalism fell with him. Nixon was not quite one of them, but he had governed on liberal terms. And with him went not only some of those terms, but something more. Americans trust that government can and should promote the common good. The left, however, could not see how they were invested in him. Years after his presidency, Nixon remained so toxic among liberals that to avoid angering their readers, both the New York Times and the Washington Post, the paragons of free speech refused to publish ads for his presidential memoir. That is so powerful. I think that a lot of people who think of themselves as progressives or liberals really don't see that. They don't see the connection. They think of Nixon as a conservative president. 50 years ago, He was conservative in many ways, but he was also very liberal in many ways. And when he went down, that changed our history.
That's right. Ronald Reagan cements the blue-collar strategy of Nixon. But his outlook is much more Barry Goldwater than Richard Nixon on the role of government. And Nixon not only, you know, and you know, I think one reason Nixon's misunderstood is that the private Nixon, the man who comes out in those tapes, is so much darker than the public Nixon, actually. For as much as and as polarizing as he was, the Nixon that came out in those tapes was so shocking at the time to hear a president talk like that. And I don't just mean the profanity. I mean everything about him. Again, Nixon is such a fascinating figure because he's just so incongruent. He's one of the most well-read presidents of the century, and yet he's so simplistic on those tapes and reductive and at times bigoted and racist, and yet, the public Nixon had supported every significant civil rights act. He had opposed McCarthyism. There was just a lot about Nixon that I think is misunderstood. And of course, OSHA, the Environmental Protection Agency, immense agencies of progress are begun in affirmative action, I should note, in the Nixon era. So he's an extremely complicated man, and of course, that's one reason there's so many books about him. But his role as the precursor of what became Reagan Democrats, and how he seized upon the hard, the division that Hart had right exposed, and the blue collar unrest it foretold, Nixon's role laying the framework for Ronald Reagan's strategy, and again, those Reagan Democrats, and what eventually led to, sort of explains George W. Bush's success and Donald Trump eventually, I think is still misunderstood. And when you go back to that America of the late 60s and early 70s, and especially the third half of the book, and you start to see Nixon's blue-collar strategy and how he's appealing to that silent majority, quote-unquote, you see all the resonance of today and today's polarization.
And it seems somewhat ironic that 50 years later, a president who in some large part owes his presidency to what Nixon did 50 years ago by splitting up these coalitions, is dismantling some of the things that Nixon put together, like the Environmental Protection Agency. It's just very, very ironic.
And it's also the adoption of the language of Nixon without understanding the context in which he used it is there's a giant chasm between those two things. I mean, you can talk about law and order all you want if you're the current president, but there simply is not anywhere near the crime rate that America was suffering in the late 60s, mm-hmm. early 70s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's for as much a turmoil as we are experiencing today, and we are, it's just, you know, you had some 250 cities experiencing riots across America in the late 60s. It's just there are bombings all across New York City at, like, Macy's Herald Square, centers of where tourists go to this day. Uh-huh. And so the one reason I want to write this book is to return us to that moment and show a more traumatic time, you know, that we got through and the country got through, but also how it made our time and to show the narrative arc to Richard Nixon, from Richard Nixon to Donald Trump, and what, you know, separates them. Some comparisons are interesting and fair, and some are just, a little absurd.
Another element in this, which I think is important, the hard hats were feeling a sense of empowerment because, number one, the police were looking the other way, and number two, it was like a ticker tape parade. You had all these office workers cheering and throwing ticker tape down on them while they were marching down the streets with their clubs. It's really an amazing thing to imagine.
And carrying flags, and literally was a ticker tape parade. Spontaneously, office workers down Wall Street, clerks, stockbrokers, secretaries started throwing confetti out the window, started throwing that old ticker tape. And in the weeks after, as the blue-collar protests began in downtown Manhattan, and eventually nationally, I should note, as I talk about the third half of the book, in downtown Manhattan, you have several ticker tape parades. And what that shows is while Americans didn't condone the most brutal episodes of these confrontations, and certainly even with Kent State, they had grown tremendously weary of the capital M movement from the new left. And this gap between their view of the movement and the movement's view of them eventually explains why McGovern suffers in 1972 one of the greatest losses in American presidential history.
And you do a good job of showing us why he lost and why he lost by so much and how John Lindsay went from being a potential candidate in 1972 to being just a non-entity. And I made notes as I went through your book because I'm so intrigued by this period of history. And you kept mentioning people, like you just mentioned George McGovern. So I made notes and I wrote down the names of all the people you mentioned that I have interviewed, and you had 10 people in your book that I've interviewed, and I was pretty impressed.
Wow.
Do you want to hear the list?
Sure, please.
Studs Terkel, Gary Wills, Judy Collins, George McGovern, Jimmy Breslin, Richard Reeves, Doris Kearns Goodwin, John Glenn, Newt Gingrich, and Donald Trump.
Wow.
5 dead, 5 still with us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all their names evoke special moments in this book.
They do.
Their extraordinary place in this, this, you know, this, where everything was changing. I mean, what the blue-collar protests that I spoke earlier culminate with what was Time magazine called Workers' Woodstock, when they finally noticed their own readers.
Mm.
And we're starting to notice their own readers. And they and it's 150,000 protesting in downtown Manhattan, more for America and trying to support their troops and against the anti-war movement than necessarily for the war itself. And you and in this moment where they're in the streets, you see the resonance of what of not only what the coalition the Democrats had lost, but the voice that they suddenly discovered in themselves, and also you see the risk when a public, after years of feeling estranged by a movement, can eventually galvanize against that movement. So you also have you have warnings for both the center and the left in this moment, and you have an epically resonant moment. And again, what we think of today as sort of as Reagan Democrats.
Mm. The book is The Hard Hat Riot, Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the White Working Class Revolution, written by David Paul Kuhn. David, tell us a little bit about yourself. What got you into this line of work? What kind of stuff have you done? Who are you, David?
I was trained as a reporter. I spent my most of my youth in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I interned when I was in high school for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Interned at many small newspapers across the country, and eventually by the 2000 campaign, earned my way to the internship on the political department of Time magazine and covered the 2000 race, and then 2004 for CBS News, and then several presidential elections after that. And in the George W. Bush era, I just happened to notice one thing I called it was the white male gap, this giant gap that the media was misunderstanding, the gender gap, and why Republicans were winning mad. And this, I felt that they were undercovering how Republicans came to win or misunderstanding whites in the last 40 years at that time. So I wrote a book on that in the late 2000s, which was called Antiquated, because it was all about the Reagan Democrats. And then that, of course, became more resonant when Donald Trump won the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And as the Great Recession happened, I just sort of happened to keep writing about this subject matter. And, I think it was an accident that I focused in on it. And it was mainly because I felt like it was a undercover subject. And I also think it's a part of America that is so immense. And the gap between its size and influence and how it's understood by the coastal class or by book culture and academia, I think is probably as large as any gap in American life, in terms of a gap between the intelligentsia and the country that they live within.
And there's something to be said for tailoring the image when a politician can do that. John Lindsay wasn't very good at adapting, at tailoring his image. And then you point to, in passing near the end of the book, how George W. Bush was able to tailor his image from being somewhat patrician in appearance to being more kind of an aw shucks, good old boy, you know, who would talk the talk and appeal to that middle-class voter.
That's right. I mean, George W. Bush loses his first congressional race by being portrayed as a Yankee daddy's boy in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time he makes an upset in Texas and wins the governorship, he's campaigning as the son of a president and grandson of a senator, is campaigning as a oil man from West Texas, a religious man. And his religion was obviously sincerely felt. But he had redefined himself. And in some ways, that's a very American tale. And in another, it shows the power of cultural populism in American life. And, you know, when you allow for that, when you allow for cultural issues, when you lose touch with the cultural mores of your public, and you allow for your opponent to seize upon the gap between you and between the governed and the governors.
As we look back 50 years at the Hard Hat Riot and the circumstances of that and the historical arc of that period, I think it's easy to think, oh, gee, this is the most fascinating period in American history. But we can say that almost every day. I think we're in that period right now. Again, I think what's going on right now is incredible. Do you have any prognostications about where we're at as far as what's going to happen with the election? Who's going to be elected president? Any thoughts on that? I know you're a journalist, but what do you think?
Well, there's a reason. I took a risk because I put this book to press late last year, and I took a risk in the closing chapter. I note that in 1972, when Richard Nixon wins his landslide election, one of the few Democratic victories was in a young 29-year-old senator named Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
Because I did actually think he was going to win the Democratic primary.
Mm.
And that's why I end on that note and note him.
What's your prognosis on what's going to be happening here with this election? Are we going to actually have an election? What's going to be going on with balloting? What's going to be going on with the election? Who's going to win?
The answer is, I'd say nothing's for certain. But yes, we're going to have an election.
Uh-huh.
Yes, if the race is very close, it could be. It could lead to all the issues that you're suggesting. And at the same time, it's fair to say that I just point out that while I was warned in 2016 that Hillary Clinton should not want to face Donald Trump and so forth, it is fair to say today that at this lead that Joe Biden has, if Donald Trump doesn't radically change his presidency and his strategy, he will lose in November, and he will not likely be redeemed politically by history. He really has to... If you separate yourself from the cultural turmoil of this moment, you know, his presidency was made possible by the white working class. And, you know, it's fair to say that, you know, they're caught between the fact that they feel like the antagonists of liberalism. They feel like they're constantly stereotyped by the very people who claim to have an open mind. And at the same time, you know, they're forced to be defined by Donald Trump entirely, right? Just because a vote for him, as I put it, is not a vote for everything about him. And unfortunately, in American life, people are forced to choose between two candidates. And I think that if Donald Trump loses, unfortunately, I think the media and our coastal culture will forget about this part of America all over again. And I think that's only going to further cement the polarization that plagues us today.
Yeah. David, we really appreciate your time, and we really appreciate you talking about your book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The book is The Hard Hat Riot, Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the White Working Class Revolution, written by David Paul Kuhn, who joins us on the phone in Connecticut today. Are you working on another book?
Not yet. I'm trying to think about what would make for the best next book. Right now, I'm just trying to focus on talking about this book and getting it out there and helping readers understand why writing about yesterday and this era is so critical to understanding today.
All right. Well, thanks again. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.